You are tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. This is a 7-hour block of special programming in commemoration of National Aboriginal Day. Please stay tuned for interviews, documentaries, and music produced by, with, and for Indigenous folks here at CITR and beyond.
Listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
You're listening to Unceded Airwaves by the Indigenous Collective at CITR 101.9 FM.
What time of day should I sing my song? Should I sing it in the morning before anything goes wrong? There's only me and you and a honeysuckle dew. I can sing I love you. And you know, I really do. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Unceded Airwaves is broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Unceded Airwaves broadcasts every week from the traditional, ancestral, unceded lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. You're listening to Season 2, Episode 26 of Unceded Airwaves. On today's show, we'll be having a panel discussion on cultural appropriation and a recent article by Hal Needs-Vecchi in Right, the Writers Union of Canada magazine, suggesting that there should be a literary prize for cultural appropriation and the media storm that followed. Tanche, Carly, Dishnik, and Shon. Hello, my name is Carly. My ancestry is Cree Métis on my dad's side and Icelandic on my mom's side. My Métis family is originally from the Red River Settlement in Manitoba, but I was raised outside the community on unceded Stotlo territory. I acknowledge that I'm an unceded guest, an uninvited guest on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. Marci to the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people who host us today on their territory.
Wache, Josh Kioki in Shinnikasen, Dwapskatindanum. My name is Josh Kioki. I'm from the Adopscat First Nation. I also have a settler Canadian ancestry from, you know, the UK. And I'm a student here as well on the unceded territory of the Musqueam people. And I'm pleased to be joining you today, Carly, for this discussion.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to crush it. So who are we? We are the Indigenous Radio Collective. Every week we discuss Indigenous issues, current events, and entertainment. We're a collective of Indigenous and non-Indigenous students who use our weekly airtime for our own self-representation.
We strive to center Indigenous voices on our show and to build narratives that empower Indigenous people. Self-representation in media is something that Indigenous people do not often have access to. The show gives us the opportunity to share and define who we are as Indigenous people. Our cultures are incredibly diverse, and the nuances of our diversity are not always represented in mainstream broadcast media.
It can be difficult to find positive Indigenous role models in popular media, so this show offers an opportunity to highlight some influential Indigenous people.
If you can relate to the goals of our show and you're wondering how to get involved, please reach out to us. You can always reach us on our social media. We have Facebook and Twitter. No Instagram, no Snapchat, but that's okay.
Oh, Snapchat.
We'll get there. No. I think both of those are on their way out. It's fine.
Yeah, that's it. They're
unlike Facebook and Twitter. If you have a voice for decolonization, then we want to hear from you. Everyone's welcome. There's no experience necessary. Our weekly meeting does not really occur in the summertime, but we've got a like page that you can figure out on Facebook who to get in touch with if you want to get involved over the summer. Help us put on our summer programming as we're not really on hiatus, but we're not meeting as a group regularly. So just reach out to us. We will let you know how you can get involved. There are plenty of other ways you can participate. If you want to send us in, Indigenous artists that you're listening to and all that. You can do that.
Thanks, buddy.
Sure.
You can follow Unceded Airways on Facebook and Twitter. We're always looking to hear from our listeners about what you're up to. We'll have our weekly Unceded events listing to share a little later in the show. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know if we have any events. This is all about the panel today.
Maybe.
Yeah, okay. You want to do some shout-outs?
Okay. So, shout-out to those occupying their territories. Maddie Lee of the Gixan Nation, Unstoten of the Wet'suwet'en peoples, those occupying Lilu Island in the Tsimshian Territory, the Tsilhqot'en Nation, who are legally battling Taseko Mine Limited's project, Nacho Nyakdin, Trondek Gwech'in, Tetlet Gwech'in, and Vundet Gwech'in, peoples fighting to protect the Peel River watershed.
Yeah, we're still waiting to hear back from that. That case is currently sitting at the Supreme Court of Canada, and we're waiting to see if it's the people versus the Yukon government on that one.
All right. Huge thanks to our sponsors, NORAD Electric, Taltan owned and operated. NORAD Electric was formed 30 years ago. They do commercial, industrial, residential electric work, and they're owned and operated by Norman Day of the Taltan Nation. We are also sponsored by Decolonizing Water, which I guess as a disclaimer or I'll just disclose that I do work for them. So, you know, if you find that weird, just disclosing it. But anyway, Decolonizing Water is a project that aims to support water security for Indigenous communities. The project is funded by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council. The project will run from 2016 to 2023 and brings together leading Indigenous thinkers, natural scientists, artists, lawyers, and community members. Rooted in Indigenous law, it will use the most innovative Western scientific advancements in monitoring technology to create a hybridized water governance and monitoring program.
Okay, great. I think we're going to hear a song now from Zibuwan. This song is called Loon Song, and it's from the Time Limits EP on RPM Records. Zibuwan is Anishinaabe from the Wikwimikong Unceded First Nation on Manitoulin Island.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here,
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody.
God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Isn't there anything, 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 anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine, or check us out online at CITR.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
The most powerful motivational speeches that I have ever heard came from people who told me I couldn't do something. You know why? Because when they told me I couldn't do it, I was bound and determined to show them that I could.
All Access Pass is back for season 2. We are a collectively run weekly program that discusses equity, inclusion, and accessibility issues on and off UBC's campus, including both visible and invisible disabilities. You can catch All Access Pass every Thursdays from 2 to 3 p.m. Anyone can get involved. No experience is necessary. People of all abilities are welcome to join. Check us out on Facebook at All Access Pass or get involved by emailing accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Welcome back. These two unceded airwaves. We are broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Hunkaminum speaking Musqueam people, and we're talking about cultural appropriation and the recent hubbub around that. The spring issue of Right, the Writers Union of Canada magazine, features content by some fiercely talented and knowledgeable Indigenous writers, including Richard Van Camp, Alicia Elliott, and Joshua Whitehead. Topics such as writing with empathy versus writing with love, writing about reconciliation, and using humor as a method of coping with trauma are discussed, as well as industry challenges for Indigenous publishing houses like Higadonse Press. What surprised some, if not all, of these contributors, as well as many of those involved what could be called the CanLit community, but seems to be more commonly referred to lately as the CanLit dumpster fire, was an opinion piece by now former Write editor Hal Niedzwiecki, titled Winning the Appropriation Prize, which details Niedzwiecki's views on cultural appropriation. In his own words, "I don't believe in cultural appropriation. In my opinion, anyone, anywhere, should be encouraged to imagine other peoples, other cultures, other identities. I'd go so far as to say that there should be even an appropriation, an award for doing so, the Appropriation Prize for best book by an author who writes about people who aren't even remotely like her or him." What followed was a brief outline of Niedzwiecki's views on appropriation, which he appears to define as writers imagining other cultures, and his concerns that the ongoing discussion about appropriation is discouraging white writers from exploring experiences outside of their own. Many have expressed surprise and anger about the editorial, which appears to undercut the Indigenous authors in the issue.
Thanks for that. Josh? Sorry, we're just having some technical difficulties here.
So Gaderi Akwenze Dam, Chippewas of Nawash First Nation, Sagin Ojibwe Nation, is also a contributor to the special issue of Right, told Indian Country Today that Niedzwiecki's insensitive piece completely undermines and attempts to silence those voices and the intent of the issue, which I understood was to provide a space for Indigenous voice and perspectives.
Niedzwiecki has since resigned as editor of Write and issued an apology. The Writers Union of Canada has also issued an apology, with the Writers Union of Canada Equity Task Force issuing a statement calling for, among other things, a retraction of the piece, anti-racist education for all staff, affirmative action hiring practices, and paid editorial positions for Indigenous writers, racialized writers, writers with disabilities, and trans writers. Several Canadian journalists responded to Needsbeki's resignation with a call to make the appropriation prize a real thing, going so far as to solicit donations for the prize on Twitter. Many prominent writers and editors for the National Post, The Walrus, Rogers Media, The Globe and Mail, and CBC News pledged money for the prize. Jarrett Martineau, Nahia, and Dene Solin from Frog Lake First Nation in Alberta, creative producer at RPM Records, circulated a list of those who offered to support the prize. Many of those on the list have apologized or clarified their positions. Jonathan Kay, editor of The Walrus, resigned from this position yesterday, Sunday, May 14th. There are so many things wrong with the situation, it's hard to know where to start. For one thing, the mainstream media's conflation of cultural appropriation with free speech is simply not accurate, and we'll get to that later in the show. Also, the confusion of free speech with speech free from consequences, including critique from Indigenous peoples, has been glaringly apparent in this debate, both on Twitter and in media coverage. An article in the Globe and Mail strangely appealed for a debate on cultural appropriation as if that wasn't what was happening and as if it hasn't been happening for years. On Twitter, non-Indigenous journalists and writers portrayed anyone opposing their authority as an angry mob. The eagerness of non-Indigenous journalists and writers like Needsbeki to weigh in on issues they haven't sufficiently engaged with, and the speed in which they characterize voices of dissent as violent or uncivilized still manages to amaze me, though it's nothing new. Not to mention, it kind of makes the case for not appropriating Indigenous stories, since deep engagement is necessary to write about a culture you're not familiar with. In any case, this discussion is not intended to defame Needsbeki, nor is it really to deconstruct his piece specifically, but he throws us some great talking points here to get the conversation started. So, if they're on the line, I'd like to introduce our panelists today. Oh, boy, there's some. Alicia Elliott is a Tuscarora writer. Her writing has been published in the Malahat Review, The New Quarterly, and Grain. She joins us today from Brantford, Ontario. Jacqueline Valencia is a senior literary editor of the Rusty Took and board member of Canadian Women in Literary Arts, and she's joining us from Toronto. We also have Jonathan Q, our spoken word coordinator here at CITR. He's in the studio with us today. He'll be jumping in every once in a while and also helping us with our tech. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge that there are voices that aren't represented in this discussion, and that includes members of the disabled and trans communities. If you're listening today and want to contribute to the conversation on appropriation, I would love to hear from you, and I urge you to contact me at Indigenous Collective, that's all one word, at CITR.ca. Whether you have a statement you'd like us to include in a future show, or you want to call in or come by the studio, if we need to have another show about this, we'll have another show, but we want to hear from you. Okay. Jacqueline and Alicia, are you guys there?
I am. I can barely hear sometimes, so.
Okay. How about Alicia? We got Alicia? I know. Does it sound like we're all in outer space?
A little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe we'll just go to another song while we're waiting for this. Hang on the line with us, guys. We'll get this sorted. Thank you. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Okay, let's get this conversation started. We've got Alicia and Jacqueline on the phone. Let's go around the virtual table here and hear from both of our panelists. First question, is the cultural appropriation debate interfering with free speech? Alicia Elliott.
Well, I don't think that the issue ever really was free speech, at least in terms of white people's free speech. I mean, they've been speaking for us for how many years? Through legislation, through, you know, making our ceremonies illegal, through giving us their language and taking ours away. Like, their free speech has not been an issue. The problem is that we are saying no, and we are asking that they speak for themselves and let us speak for ourselves. That's the issue.
Yeah, thank you, Alicia. Jacqueline Valencia, what do you have to say on the issue?
I think that it's a way, I'm not sure that if it's something that people do it intentionally or not, but it's a way of confusing the issue. And I think people have the issue totally confused of there being, like, the term being a political correctness and the term being that we're interfering with free speech, when in reality all we're doing is speaking our minds and speaking against something that we feel very passionate about. And by saying that it's just basically people just wanting to shut things down is a way of shutting us down in turn.
Yes. Thank you. Kateri Akwenzi-Dam was kind enough to send us a statement on this. She says, this is not a showdown between those in favor of free speech and those opposed to appropriation. Although some in the Canadian mainstream media have framed it and continue to frame it that way, Indigenous writers opposed to appropriation of our intellectual cultural property are not trying to censor or ban others from using their imaginations. First of all, we don't have the power to censor or ban non-Indigenous writers from writing anything, nor do we have the resources to enforce such a thing. It's ridiculous. Secondly, this debate has been happening on and off since at least the late 80s. That's actually what this was about, it would have happened by now. No one's arguing against free speech. It's a straw man. And that was Kateria Quincy-Dam, who was kind enough to send us in a statement. Jacqueline Valencia, in your piece in The Puritan, Conceptualism in the Resistance, you said, there are inherent problems in our literary culture, especially in education. We must continue to expand the foundation of our writing world beyond the white male canons we're taught in school. Disadvantaged voices struggling to be heard must continue to resist, to activate, and to claim space. How do you define cultural appropriation in the context of claiming space?
I believe that we have a duty to take up space with our own stories and that we should be heard in those spaces. It's a point of, I try to approach everything nowadays, especially in activism and when we deal with appropriation, in a place of empathy. If we're going to be listening and reading into and writing about stories, especially because as a writer, you take stories from the world. This is inherent within fiction. We must think before we do so. We must think from a space. Am I taking from a colonized space? Am I taking from a place that is suffering? Am I taking from a place of pain? And then go on from there. I think we can evolve writing by thinking beyond the margins, as they say, as how the topic is in free speech. We must think beyond the box by doing so.
Yeah, thank you. I like what you're saying about empathy. Alicia Elliott, in your piece that appeared in the now infamous issue of Right, you said empathy has its limits. And contrary to what some may think, it's possible to have both empathy for a person and still hold inherited, unacknowledged racist views about them. Alicia, why would you say social and historical context and established relationships are both important when writing characters from marginalized communities?
I think that, you know, when you're from a marginalized community, you inherently carry the history of discrimination inside of you. You're carrying that from your ancestors. That is your inheritance, whether you want it or not, that the discrimination, the ways that the system is set up for you to fail. And so I think that when you're coming from another culture, you don't have that knowledge. It's part of your, if you want to write about that culture, it's part of your due diligence to try and understand that so that you can authentically show that. It's part of relationship building. You shouldn't be afraid to go to someone from a culture which isn't your own that you want to write about and ask them, what do you think of this? Because if you are scared of that, then maybe you should be asking yourself why you're scared of that. Is it because you don't want to hear the word no? Is that enough? Because you just don't want to hear no? Or do you actually want to do good work? Do you actually want to, you know, have someone who comes from this community come up to you and say, thank you? I just don't understand the mentality that you should be taking and taking and taking, and you aren't at all concerned that the people who you're writing about are saying, that's not me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think relationships are so much more complex than maybe many non-Indigenous writers realize, that they take time, that there's a web that someone, I do feel sometimes like I'm approached by non-Indigenous writers that are basically just looking for that, for a yes from me, as if I have any say in the matter, and maybe not understanding that in a community, there's a collective approach. So one person, if one person tells you, yeah, go ahead, write on, you're good, you should write about this, that's not enough. And even the amount of context required to understand where an Indigenous story is coming from, what times of year it was told, who it was told to, how it's evolved over the years, that's going to take a lot of time.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, okay. Something that keeps coming up in discussions with non-Indigenous writers that I have that I see this all over Facebook, I see it on Twitter, that I think needs to be settled is this: are people from marginalized communities telling white writers not to write about us? Alicia Elliott.
I don't think that that's the case at all, but I do think that something to consider, which I think that people who are white writers and, you know, people who are from other experiences, like, say, for example, someone who is cisgender trying to write a transgender experience, or someone who is an able-bodied person trying to write a disabled person's experience, I don't think they are aware, or at least they're not recognizing, that those same communities that they want to tell stories for have historically been unable to tell their own stories because there has been no place for them to tell their own stories. Their voices have been taken away from them so that these writers could write their own experiences first as white middle class, as Mr. Nijdecki pointed out in his editorial. These white middle class writers have mined their own experience, and now they're finding that that falls flat and wanting to mine other cultures' experiences the same way that their ancestors mined our culture, literally ripping from us, putting it in museums so that other white people can look at it. This is something that, you know, you have to be aware of. You are not living in a vacuum. You are living in a space where this has been happening historically for generations upon generations, and people have had to live with that pain. So, you know, you need to be aware of that. And when you are aware of that, I think, is when you approach the story with more care, approach the characters with more care, because you understand the responsibility that you have when you are trying to write about that culture. I've read books by people and short stories by people who have done a good job of doing that, I think. And, you know, it's not like it's unheard of. The problem, I think, is that it's more work than most people want to do, and so they would prefer that they can just do whatever they want and say whatever they want, and who cares if they, you know, the marginalized communities that they're writing about have a problem, then they're inhibiting their free speech. That's absurd.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Alicia. Jacqueline Valencia, do you what sort of responsibilities do you feel the poetry world in particular has when considering writing about marginalized communities?
Well, as...
we may have lost Jacqueline for a minute there.
Yeah, I think we've lost Jacqueline.
Okay, well then, Alicia, let's back to Alicia. I wanted to talk a little bit about some, as I said, the goal is not to defame Hal Nijdecki, but some of the assumptions that he made in his piece, I think, were quite problematic. One is sort of about the difference of community versus individuality. And he talked about writers' responsibilities to their community versus writers as islands, sort of, you know, with no one to answer to but the reader. Readers being the judge of how well researched or contextualized a story or character is. Do you see a problem with letting readers be the judge?
Oh, absolutely. I think that when, you know, you're presented with something that is published, the reader has an inherent trust that there was due diligence done in terms of, you know, research, in terms of reaching out and doing the work that you need to do. So they would, I think that, at least I would assume, when, you know, I'm reading something, that the person, especially something I don't know about, if it's about a culture that I don't know about, I am going to take that person's word. There is an inherent trust that a reader puts into the author. But if you don't know about something, how are you going to know it's false? I don't know about, you know, Middle Eastern cultures. So if someone wrote something about a Middle Eastern culture, how am I going to know that it's false? It just logically doesn't make sense that the reader is going to somehow know and pull this knowledge from some mysterious space where there's all of this knowledge that we can access. It just is absurd to me that that's even something that he thought was okay to say or was fair to say. I think that maybe what, and I don't want to, you know, put words in his mouth, but there is, I think, you can tell when a character is authentic in terms of, like, does a character read on a page as being, you know, flat or round. That is something that is much different than being able to tell if the culture is being depicted appropriately.
Excellent.
So they're not the same conversation at all.
Yeah.
And to posit that they are is dishonest and a bit naive.
Yeah, agreed. But I find that I've been in book clubs and so many conversations with people discussing historical fiction, which is identified, you know, right in its definition as fiction, with a bunch of folks sort of nodding sagely and say, isn't this brutal how this is what it was like way back then? It seems like the readers are eager. Many readers are eager to accept what they read as reality, even if it's been clearly defined as fiction.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that's especially the case in terms of, you know, reading historically about indigenous people. You know, how many of these books do you have to read that are written by non-indigenous writers that have specific ideas and stereotypes that they're carrying with them that they're not critically examining, that are, you know, filtering into their writing, whether they're aware of it or not. And, you know, then you have writers who are also non-Indigenous who are picking up this work, and they don't see any problems either because they also hold those stereotypes, whether they like it or not, you know, and it's just reinforcing it, and that's what makes it read to them as authentic because it's speaking to these stereotypes and these views that they have of us as people. So that makes it more authentic to them than when we write about ourselves, for example, and maybe we're not, you know, showing ourselves as drunken fools, you know what I mean? Or maybe we're not, you know, being the noble savage for them, and that to them reads as inauthentic or false. And it's not just our communities either. I remember being in a book club and there was a white woman who obviously was not from a Mennonite community who we were reading Miriam Chew's work, and she said that this was absolutely ridiculous, and Mennonite communities weren't like that, despite the fact that Miriam Hughes is from a Mennonite community and is writing from her own personal experience. She was basing this on the fact that she went to buy furniture from Mennonite communities, and she did not see any evidence of this world that Miriam Hughes depicted, which was her own experience in, you know, where she was buying furniture. So, I mean, like, there is obviously a problem where people cannot critically, you know, do the work to determine why they think one thing is authentic and one thing is not.
Yeah, agreed. Thanks, Alicia. We've got Jacqueline Valencia on the line again, so let's go back. Hi, thanks for waiting, Jacqueline. We were talking about the responsibilities of the poetry community in particular when writing characters from marginalized communities.
I was saying that since I'm not Indigenous, I can't speak to the Indigenous experience. However, what's the great thing about this controversy is that we can also, we end up reading a lot more Indigenous writers and get exposed to them a lot more. As with the right article, some of us were able to push past that and read the people who were actually in that issue, which was great. And the thing is, I think that the responsibility of the poets and poetry in general to this is that we're going through our own sort of controversy. I guess it's also mixed in with being with conceptual poetry and lyrical poetry, is like, what can we take from each other? And I think that, for me, I think it's best that we approach it from a point of freedom become a point of liberty, a point of trying to liberate those who cannot be heard. Robert Jago on Twitter wrote it best, and his Twitter handles are JJAGO. He talks about how people with Hemingway have written about Native people, and they've spoken about Native folks as a sort of interest group when they are not an interest group. They're not saying that they can't. Natives are not saying right now that you cannot speak about the Native experience. Sorry, that Natives don't want others talking about their experience without not letting them speak, not letting them be heard. So when you're reading a story or a poem about the Native experience, you're not actually hearing their voices. You're hearing a perspective outside of their voices, and they're not actually being heard. So therefore, if you're not going to let those people be heard through your poetry or your works, then maybe you should hold back and let them speak instead.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. I've got on the topic of some of the assumptions made by Nizveki in the piece, I've got another comment by Kateri Akwenzi Dam. There are many reasons to object to the article. Some of Nizveki's assertions are simply false. One that hasn't been addressed enough, in my opinion, is that Indigenous writers write what we don't know. I cannot think of one Indigenous writer who does that, not one. Even if Nizveki was basing that on very limited knowledge of Indigenous lit, no one in the issue in which he made the statement did so. Every piece in that issue is so thoughtful, personal, and beautifully written, it's painful to have him frame their work that way. Yes, of course we write about the world around us, about the many aspects of Canadian culture that we have been forced at great cost to learn about and participate in. We know it all too well. His statement completely dismisses the history of colonialism and genocide we've endured. His assertion is not only a falsehood, but a grave insult. To suggest we don't know what we're writing about demeans us and our literature. It also says that we appropriate and suggest that it's hypocritical to object when others do so. Either you want to add anything to that? I love that. I wanted to add it in. Alicia?
I love Kateri. She's so amazing, and everything she has to say is exactly on point. let me just start off by saying that. But I remember when I first read that, thinking, what does he even mean by that? Like, how am I writing what I don't know? I specifically, in my essay in that issue, which he edited, was speaking about my own personal experience of reading a short story that was culturally appropriating. So what about that did I not know? You know, like, it just boggles my mind that, you know, that was even said in the first place. And it may be that he was, you know, I like to try and think from different sides, too. So if he meant that, you know, we're writing about our culture, which we're still trying to relearn, that is a really, really awful way to phrase that. And as a white man saying you don't know your culture, I feel like he just had no idea of how that sits historically, the pain that brings up. You know, it's insane to me. Yes, like, I don't speak my language. That is awful to me. It hurts me to think about, you know, my sister is relearning, relearning her language, and it's a very long and complicated process, and that's something that we all have to actively do. We can't just, you know, magically be, oh, we're the Native that you want us to be, you know. We're going to be able to be in your, like, be doing powwow dances for you and speaking language and showing up in our regalia at your beck and call because that's the authentic Indian that you want. No, Canada specifically wanted us to not have our culture. Canada specifically wanted us not to have our language. Canada specifically wanted us not to have our land and not to have our children as well, or our families, not to have our traditional governance. And so, you know, like, to be so flippant about that and to not, you know, explain further what that means, and also to say, like, we're writing about what we don't, there's nothing about it that doesn't make me angry. Like, even just thinking about that sentence, I just get so mad. But I mean, I think it's obvious that we're writing about what we know, and I think that's what's powerful about our writing, that we're, you know, we're relearning what Canada has tried so hard to keep us from knowing, or, you know, we're keeping alive what Canada wants to stamp out, and that's what makes our literature so strong. That's what makes our art so powerful, is that it's basically sticking up its middle finger at, you know, Canada's assimilationist policies and saying, fuck you, no. Like, we're here and we're surviving and we're going to keep surviving no matter what.
Damn, that's a great place for us to segue. I feel like we could do 6 shows on this. I'm really thankful, Jacqueline Valencia and Alicia Elliott, for you that both of you were on the show today. And I just wanted to acknowledge what you're saying about being angry. There's a lot of emotional labor involved every time something like this blows up, and it seems to be constant lately. So I hope you guys are taking care of yourselves and we can take care of each other. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much
for having us.
It's a weird world out there.
Yeah, no kidding. Thanks very much, guys. Take care.
No problem. Bye-bye.
Bye. I just want to end with a quick quote from Vancouver writer Jen Sukfong Lee. Not quick. Jen can take up as much space as she needs. I teach writing students for a day job, and the issue of cultural appropriation comes up regularly. I'm not here to tell people what to write. I wouldn't be a very good teacher if I did. I say, center your characters in their own narratives, no matter how small. Do the research, ask questions, be generous and accountable to the people whom you're writing about, and then you'll be fine. I still stand behind this, but it only works if the writer understands the complicated history behind the silencing of marginalized voices and their stories. For as long as I've been publishing, literary gatekeepers have policed my narratives by saying they were too violent or disturbing or not relatable, which translates into women of color aren't allowed to write like Chuck Palahniuk or Irvin Welsh. So when white editors and writers with power push back against our criticism of the stories they appropriate, well, I don't have a lot of sympathy. They've been telling me what to write and how to write it for my entire career. Thanks very much. You're listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the unceded ancestral traditional territories of the Hunkamino-speaking Musqueam people. Big thanks to our sponsors, NORAD Electric and also Decolonizing Water. I'm Carly Baker. Josh is still here.
I'm still here.
Yeah. And Mario's here, too.
Hey, I'm here.
Mario's here. All right. Thanks very much for tuning in today. Josh, you want to finish the show off for us?
Yeah, thanks, Carly, for organizing the panel today and putting all the work in to discuss cultural appropriation. It's a huge thing. I think we sort of talk about it almost every day or every time we're on the air. I think it's a big part of what the collective coheres around, if not always explicitly. So it's good to, I don't know, take the time after this whole thing has bubbled up and talk about it. So I appreciate you putting that together.
Oh, no, it was great. So many thank you to Alicia Elliott and Jacqueline Valencia. Thank you to Jonathan Q, fighting fires for us today, and also Madeline here at CITR. We're going to play a song by Ansley Simpson next. The song's called Witness from Ansley's new album, Breakwall. Ansley is Michi Sagig Nishinabekwe, and the album is available on RPM Records.
In the quiet of the clearing, the white pines witness our bodies so close that our skin melts together. Like neon lights in the bottles on the pavement, as it runs from the spring, and I'm more tired than awake. like strangers, and they're heavy and they ache. In the quiet of the clearing, the white pines witness what we both know is at stake.